did occur to me that ringing that bell, I might have caused some of you to have body sensations, in as much as it's very much like a school bell ringing. We all have those terrible recollections of the trauma of school. So, is the mic? Jim is turning it up, I think. Here it comes. Better, better, better. Keep going. How are we doing, Jim? Yep. Okay. How? Okay. 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 Signs of life in the back rows. Okay. Good morning. Last week we saw a picture of religion in the U.S. and worldwide in which the big change appears to be a movement away from organized religion and toward secularism. We're still doing some propping here, but that's okay. On the organized religion end of things, we find people who are collectively pursuing the spiritual dimension of human life. On the secular end are people who don't really believe there is any such thing as a spiritual dimension to human life. That's sort of the definition of what secular really means. In between are people who are neither part of a religious community nor believers in what I would call pure materialism. Spirituality means something to them, but not in the form of an organized religious community. These in-betweeners, as we saw last week, are the fastest growing religious category. So the question for today is, why are these changes happening? An important source in my efforts to look at this question has been a book called Sacred and Secular by two social scientists experienced in analyzing religious behavior and attitudes. Now, to understand why people are leaving churches, it would be helpful, of course, to know why they have been going in the first place. That question and its relation to church mission are the theme of today's worship service. The 9:15ers here know that, and the 11:15ers will soon see that. The social scientists who wrote Sacred and Secular didn't describe any surveys on that question in their book, and they didn't say why not. I suspect that either such surveys don't exist, or from a social science perspective, they're considered unreliable. If you conduct a survey asking how often do you go to church and give people multiple choices, you can get fairly reliable answers. Asking someone why they go to church is much trickier and more complicated. So instead, these social scientists begin their process of determining why people are leaving organized religion by adopting some assumptions about why people became involved with organized religion. And here are those assumptions, I'm quoting. Virtually all of the world's major religious cultures, they say, provide reassurance that even though the individual alone can't understand or predict what lies ahead, a higher power will ensure that things work out. To those of you who were here at 9:15, this will sound familiar. Both religion and secular ideologies assure people that the universe follows a plan which guarantees that if you follow the rules, everything will turn out well in this world or in the next world. This belief reduces stress, enabling people to shut out anxiety and focus on coping with their immediate problems. Hi, John and Jane. Realized that I needed to expand the ambit of my vision there a little bit. People go to church, these social scientists assert, to alleviate such stresses. Standing on these assumptions, they then look at statistical profiles of who is leaving organized religion and who's staying. The pivotal correlation they draw from all of the survey data is this, quote, experiences of growing up in less secure societies will heighten the importance of religious values, while conversely, experiences of more secure conditions will lessen it. Elaborating on this hypothesis, they continue, and I'm quoting, as societies transition from agrarian to industrial economies and then develop into post-industrial societies, like the United States, the conditions of growing security that usually accompany this process tend to reduce the importance of religious values. The main reason, we believe, this is the social scientist speaking, is that the need for religious reassurance becomes less pressing under conditions of greater security. Greater protection, and control, longevity, and health found in post-industrial nations mean that fewer people in these societies regard traditional spiritual values, beliefs, and practices as vital to their lives or the lives of their community. We expect that people living in advanced industrial societies will often grow increasingly indifferent to traditional religious leaders and institutions and become less willing to engage in spiritual activities. So that's the hypothesis. The social scientists offer three kinds of data to support it. The first is shown in screen 20, and it's something we saw last week, showing correlation between material security and religious participation. And you see that the least materially secure societies, the agrarian ones, have the highest participation and the post-industrial ones the lowest. Other similar studies are cited in this book, Sacred and Secular. This correlation is confirmed by studies showing correlations between religious participation and what are called human development factors or considerations. And I'm going to try to walk you through what those are right now. There are four groups of these human development factors or considerations. The first one, the educational group, is on screen 21. It shows that the higher the illiteracy rate, the higher the level of religious participation. And the higher the educational level and access to mass communication, the lower the level of religious participation. So notice the dynamic that's being suggested there. The second of the four groups, the healthcare group, is on screen 22. It shows that the higher the number of AIDS cases and the infant mortality rate and the child mortality rate, the higher the level of participation in religion. Those correlations are positive. The greater the access to improved water sources and doctors, the lower the level of religious participation. So those correlations are negative. All this is based on elaborate statistical studies that these screens represent the conclusions of. The third group of human development factors is the demographics group, and it's on screen 23. I hope everybody, or as many people as we had copies for, have copies of the screens in front of you so you can use those too. This shows that the greater the overall population growth rate and the greater the percentage of the population 14 and under, the higher the level of religious participation. On the other hand, the greater the life expectancy at birth and the greater the percentage of the population 65 and over, the lower the level of religious participation. The fourth and last group is socioeconomic development, and it's on screen 24. It shows that the greater the urban portion of the population and the per capita gross domestic product, the lower the level of religious participation. On the other hand, the greater the rural portion of the population and the greater the degree of income inequality in the society, the higher the level of religious participation. Now, the one about income inequality may look like a little bit of a puzzle, and the social scientists clarify this elsewhere by saying it is the group on the unfavorable end of the income inequality whose religious participation is accounting for the overall higher level in a society that has that kind of income inequality. And then this screen also just shows that the greater the composite overall human development in a society, the more highly developed commercially and industrially it is, the lower the level of religious participation. So basically what this evaluation of human factors, human development factors, is showing is all the good ones, all the positive ones that move a society toward being more developed. You can't call them unmitigated goods because development and civilizing can bring problems with it, but all those pro-developmental ones tend to reduce religious participation, and the anti-developmental ones, like infant mortality, high infant mortality rates and things like that, tend to increase the level of religious participation. So they think this supports their hypothesis about material security causing a decline in religious participation. The second kind of supporting data that the social scientists cite is found in studies showing declines in religious participation over time. And here are the results of two such studies, which we also looked at last week. We'll just look at them briefly again. Screen 25 shows declines in religious participation in Europe over a 30-year period, and the declines, as you can see, are very dramatic. And screen 26 shows parallel declines in the U.S., not as dramatic, but still very substantial. The number of people going to church weekly or more going down significantly, the number of people who never attend going up very significantly. The third kind of supporting data is from studies showing a correlation between age and religious participation. We saw these last week too. Screen 27 suggests a trend of declining identification with religion over time. And the way age is being used as a marker for this is you have two populations here, essentially. One you can call present young adults, and the other, which is most of us in this room, you can call former young adults. And so what we're looking at is at like a time-lapse photograph of what young adults think. The ones who were young adults, you know, 20, 30 years ago and more, and the ones who are young adults today. So that tells us something about where the society is moving. Screen 28 shows a similar decline for religious participation. You'll remember last week we looked at religious identification, which is when you ask people what do they say they are, and participation, which shows the kinds of activities they actually engage in. And then screen 29 again shows a decline in religious participation, this time using international data. Now, this is the point in this program where your head really ought to be spinning with the statistics. This is, as I promised you at the beginning, a narrow, concentrated extraction of an immense volume of data that relates to all this. So the question is, does this kind of evidence prove that increasing material security is causing a decline in religious participation? That's the big question of the day. The social scientists did not look at evidence of material security changing over time in those post-industrial societies where they showed that in those societies there's a significant religious decline in religious participation, like the United States. They didn't look at what material security was doing over the same period of time that they studied declining religious participation. They took present tense snapshots of that. They showed decline over time in religious participation, but they didn't analyze what was happening at the same time with material security. If they had found such changes in material security happening in parallel with changes in religious participation, then there might be a basis to conclude that increases in material security cause a decrease in religious participation. But they didn't do that. Now, you might say, well, do we really need to study the situation on material security in societies like the United States? We all know the United States had shifted from being an agrarian society to being an industrial one long before 1970. And that's the beginning point of these studies we've been looking at, showing the decline in religious participation, 70 to 2000 or thereabouts. So if the level of material security in the United States was unchanged throughout that period of declining religious participation, 1970 to 2000 and up to the present, then it would seem that the studies relied on by the social scientists actually disprove their material security hypothesis. You see why? If the decline in religious participation happened without any corresponding increase in material security, then the cause of the decline in religious participation has to lie elsewhere. I'm baffled at why they didn't study the longitudinal picture, as they would say in their jargon, on material security in societies like the United States and Western Europe, but they didn't. Now, even if it could be shown that increasing material security causes declining religious participation, we'd still need to look at whether there are other causes as well. A prime candidate for such an other cause is education. This is shown in the same studies the social scientists cite in support of their material security hypothesis. And screen 30 is a repeat of one of those human development screens that we saw before just a few minutes ago. And it shows that increased literacy, education, and access to mass communications go hand in hand with decreasing religious participation. It's pretty intuitive. It's not surprising that these three things would be grouped together: literacy, education, and access to mass communications. But what this chart is showing is that those are a correlation, at least. They correlate with declining religious participation. They may not cause it. Big difference between causing and correlating, but they do correlate, which means they have to be looked at. The same correlation can be seen in the Pew Forum study, which is the one that just got finished a few months ago that we've looked at a lot, when we line up the religious participation variable with education and income. Here are two screens from last week, 31. And you may remember this one about religious participation and how the same groups wind up on the low end on all these and the same groups wind up on the high end. We looked at that. And then 32 is the same thing as to one of those factors with Unitarian Universalists brought into the picture. So screen 33 now shows these same groupings, same groups on either end. And what it's doing is showing that low religious participation is correlated with high income and education. And it's important to know here that racial discrimination obviously has suppressed the income and education levels of those attending the historically African-American churches. We wouldn't want to leave that unsaid. But what we're concerned with here is what's the correlation between income and education on the one hand and religious participation on the other. And we see that both of them correlate. So to evaluate whether increased education actually causes declining religious participation rather than merely correlating with it, we would once again need to look at data showing whether movement in the level of religious participation over time matches movement in the level of education over the same period of time and in the same place. We'd need to do the same kind of longitudinal look, longitudinal studies about education and religion that the social scientists didn't give us about material security and religious participation either. Now, the social scientists reject education as a causative factor without looking at the longitudinal data. They don't cite any. They cite evidence of favorable attitudes towards science in some societies with low education levels and unfavorable attitudes towards science in some societies with high education levels. And from this, they conclude they don't really need to worry about education as a variable here in light of that picture. But the attitudes that they're citing here are about whether science is good for socioeconomic development and whether it needs to be managed in order to avoid unintended effects like genetic engineering of crops and things like that that we've all heard about. These issues are very different from whether a society sees science as the dominant paradigm for explaining the material world. All post-industrial societies look at science that way. It's very basic to the world outlook of societies at that level of development. And that outlook, which comes with higher levels of education, may be an important cause of declining religious participation. That possibility can't be dismissed without studying the longitudinal data on education levels to see what it was doing over the 30 years when religious participation was declining. I suspect it was going up, but we don't know the answer to that. Now, the social scientists acknowledge that increased material security and higher education levels tend to go hand in hand when societies move from agrarian to industrial to post-industrial. And they say it's difficult to disentangle these two strands. But I don't see how we can give up on disentangling them without looking at the longitudinal data on both. I hate to sound like such a broken record about that, but that's the missing piece here. There are these longitudinal studies, not of religious participation, they've got that, but of the two secular factors that they're trying to correlate it with, or should be trying to correlate it with, increasing material security or not, and increasing education or not. So we need a clear understanding of the reasons why people are leaving organized religion so that churches can consider how to respond to what might be assessed as an unmet need here. And I don't think the social scientists have given us that understanding with this material security theory, particularly when they don't really deal with education as a significant causative factor. Now, education introduces people to new ways of looking at the world. Might those new ways have some impact on declining participation in religion? One of the trends noted in the Sacred and Secular book suggests they might. The social scientists acknowledge what they call an exception to their hypothesis about the correlation of increasing material security and declining religious participation. It's depicted in screen 34, which shows a significant rise over the past 30 years in how often people think about, quote, the meaning of life, unquote, at least in the most highly developed societies. And when you look at these percentages, remember, the important percentage is the one that's reflected by the difference between the two columns of different colors. So you're seeing some pretty big jumps in the portion of society that's thinking often about the meaning of life. Let me just read you some of those percentages. In South Korea, it's a 40% upward jump. In Argentina, a 75% upward jump. In Sweden, a 90% upward jump. In Canada, 40%. Mexico, 50%. Japan, 25%. And then there are a couple. I don't know what's happening in Spain and Great Britain, but they're just not thinking about the meaning of life as much in those two countries. But anyway, my point is these are very substantial increases in this particular kind of behavior that was surveyed and that these social scientists are reporting on in their book. And they acknowledge the import of this. And here's what they say, and it's really important. Quote, although church attendance is declining, spiritual concerns more broadly are not disappearing. Unquote. It's really important. I think this new trend calls into further question the whole material security hypothesis. If reassurance about material security was the prime reason why those now leaving churches have been attending, I don't think we would see this trend. Whatever people's reason for coming to church long ago might have been, the increase in thinking about the meaning of life suggests that in recent times, their reasons have not been simply to seek reassurance from religion about material security, to be told that a higher power is going to make everything all right and they don't need to worry about it anymore. The departing people may be not so much disenchanted with the idea of organized religion as they are with the current failure of organized religion to grasp how they are looking at their lives now. Asking questions like, does my life matter? Is it possible for part of me that feels unfulfilled to feel fulfilled? And if so, how? Or looking around at their material security and affluence and asking, is this really all there is? And that last question, as the 915ers know, is the focal point of today's worship service. If that's what's going on behind the shift away from organized religion, then the shift may not portend a broader trend toward secularism. It may simply mean that people are increasingly looking at alternatives to organized religion in their efforts to have a meaningful spiritual life. This possibility is underscored by data from the Pew Forum study, which we've been looking at a lot in this program, showing that belief in God or in a universal spirit is widespread even among groups on the low end of the spectrum of participation in organized religion. Let's look one more time at those screens from last week showing the bunching of certain groups at the low and high ends of this spectrum. 35 and 36, first screen 35, which you've now seen several times, is about participation and these bunchings on the low and high end, and 36 is the second one that shows the same thing. Now, if we take this same configuration of religious groups and plug in information on belief in God or a universal spirit, as shown in screen 37, we see a very interesting pattern. The same groups are at the low and high end, and the highest one on the low end is still lower than the lowest one on the high end, which was true for every one of those factors on the preceding two screens, 35 and 36. The highest one on the low end was lower than the lowest one on the high end. But here, that's just barely true. The lowest one on the high end is 97%, and the highest one on the low end is 94%. And generally, the disparity, the large disparities that we saw with other forms of participation in organized religion aren't there. This spiritual marker of belief in God or a universal spirit, which is a pretty broad category, shows much smaller disparities. So what that's telling us is lots of people who don't participate in organized religion very much nonetheless have some degree of belief in God or a universal spirit. So this trend toward more thinking about the meaning of life also shines a light, I think, on the difficulties the social scientists get themselves into by treating material security as the only kind of security that's relevant to the question of religious participation. What are we doing here? We need to get on with this. What are you laughing at? The social scientists acknowledged that sociology of religion used to conceive of security very narrowly when they studied this kind of thing, solely in terms of military strength sufficient to prevent a foreign invasion. In the last decade, they say, sociologists began to take a broader view of the causes of insecurity, focusing on natural disasters, epidemics, poverty, violations of human rights as causes of insecurity. Now, the authors of Sacred and Secular seem to be on board with this broadening of the definition of what it means to live in a secure environment, up to a point. They observe that the wide range of dangers, and I'm quoting, means that the concept of human security can become so broad and overloaded that it can lose all coherence and practical utility. And then here comes the really important part. Quote, as well as becoming difficult or even impossible to gauge with a single composite measure, unquote. So this is a way of saying that if we let the concepts here get too messy, we won't be able to use sociological tools and protocols to study these things. But the messiness is in the reality to be studied here, isn't it? So to say, well, you know, we have to kind of gloss over all that because otherwise we can't do sociology strikes me as a little odd. Some of the most insecure people I know are both materially well off and highly educated. And from time to time, if I'm honest, I have to put my own name on that list. The social scientists emphasize that the critical factor in people's sense of security is found in the conditions that prevailed during their formative childhood years. Sounds right to me. But children see all sorts of things as threatening that don't actually pose any jeopardy at all to their material security, their physical well-being. A disapproving look, I know this from experience, I have children, from a parent can be as wounding as a serious illness. It's all relative. Many people may well seek out religion because of a sense of insecurity, including insecurities we still carry around from childhood. But if so, it seems implausible that only their material insecurities walk them through the door of a church, and not their psychological or spiritual insecurities, such as insecurity about who I am, what the purpose of my life is, what values I should serve, and so on. I think the evidence relied on by the social scientists certainly does suggest at least some connection between material security and religious participation. And from our own experience, we can see how easy it is to become disconnected from spiritual consciousness when we insulate our lives too heavily against uncertainty. Willingness to take risks and be surprised is an important part of that spiritual consciousness. We can also notice that important openings into spiritual growth often come with serious loss and other events that create a sense of urgency and insecurity. As we continue to seek the best spiritual practices as a church, we need to be aware that material security is not an unmitigated good. You can have such a thing as too much of a good thing, right? For all that, the data don't convince me of a causal relationship between material security and religious participation. Social scientists haven't addressed the possibility that the reasons people go to church have changed, because they never studied those. They assumed them at the beginning of the studies based on what was traditionally true. And with those changes, it's possible what has happened is that as a result of education and new ways of thinking, people view their spiritual lives differently. And not finding religious institutions that support them in this new perspective, they are voting with their feet. If churches become more responsive to these new developments, the outcome could be entirely different. And I don't mean in a consumerist sense of let's serve up, you know, whatever the market demands. There's a distinction there that has to be kind of walked. But I'm not talking about that. I am talking about paying attention to where people are when one is thinking about what a religious movement's mission really ought to be. So the possibility that these outcomes could be different is saying something important to us about mission, I think. In addition to addressing that in this morning's worship service, we will carry this reflection on mission to a further level in the third and final session of this program next week. Between now and then, I ask you to ponder what it might be like to be the religious movement that makes the correlation between education level and religious participation turn from negative to positive. Wouldn't that be exciting? I have a sense that I've shoehorned way too much into way too little time here this morning, and I'm sorry for that. I did it with the best of intentions, so if it all feels a little too intense, I was trying to give you as much of it as I could and as little of your precious time as I could. We do have some time left for questions, 15 minutes or so, so let's turn to those. Do we have some people who can help us with microphones? A couple people on either side. Somebody over here, John, thank you for doing that. Yeah, Les, you might have been first to get your hand up, and you've got the microphone.
Does it work? There we go.
It works.
Fine. I'm still processing what you had to say there, but I think there's one bit of evidence we have to bring to bear on this. I think before 9/11, we were thinking about a global village at a higher level of consciousness. This is the one time when we had a chance to really deal with the issue of security. I think we saw a spike in church attendance for about 2 or 3 weeks
exactly
and went
right.
down.
Yes.
At the same time, we have, as a level of consciousness, we've gone as a nation to basically a tribal level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't see see that spike. And so I guess I can come out of that saying that the church has had a chance to address the issue of security, and they failed.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes a lot of sense. Yep. Tracy?
Okay. There's a word in the Dutch vocabulary called the omkerking. I'm not sure when it actually came into being, but I would guess sometime in the 60s or 70s. It means breaking with the church, right? The unchurching of the society.
The unchurching of the society.
Yeah, and so prior to that time, say in our parents' generation, people of the 60s, everybody went to church. You were either Catholic or Protestant. Unfortunately, the Jewish population was very much underground. And then sometime in the 60s or 70s, they broke with this rigid, it was very rigid, whether you're Protestant or Catholic, you went to church 1, 2, 3 times a day. It was very strong hierarchy. If you had more money, you sat in the comfortable seats. If you were poor, you were in the back on the benches. So it is fascinating. And at the same time, I lived in Scandinavia in the late 80s for a short period of time. And at that time, it was when you had a big influx in all the Scandinavian countries of UN refugees from Africa, primarily. And those countries with very homogeneous values and morals saw everything that they believed in changing very rapidly. So it was interesting to see the, mm-hmm. With people believing or wondering about God and a spiritual being and why we're here. Mm-hmm. So I can see that, why that's happening too.
Very interesting. Yes, right here. Can you reach it, Roy?
The statistics don't answer some questions. For instance, why do the religious right, if church attendance is falling, why does the religious right hold such a sledgehammer in political campaigns? And two, what will happen? We're talking about materialistic well-being. What is happening right now to
mm-hmm.
people's thoughts?
Mm-hmm. It'd be pretty interesting to see. The religious right example is a pretty interesting one, I think, because there has been some growth in evangelical churches, but it's nothing like the decline on the other end of the spectrum, on the liberal end. And it is a species of religion that's very, very simple and enables people to organize and mobilize, I think, a lot easier than religions that insist on struggling with complexity. that's kind of a price I think we pay for, you know, acknowledging what we think is the reality of the complexity and not oversimplifying things. But it does create that political advantage on that side. If we looked at the slide again on income and education and how they correlated with those groups on either end of the spectrum, the evangelical churches are on the low end of income and education. And by education, by the way, I'm not trying to be snooty about this and talk just in terms of advanced degrees. Unitarian Universalism is full of those. What I really am, to me, what that education variable is really representing is an orientation of critical thinking. And you can have that if you're self-educated, you know, whether you ever went to college or whatever. But it's an attitude of critical thinking. And so those churches are on that end of that spectrum. And in the United States, it is one, you know, we talked for a moment this morning about societies where there is an unusual amount of income inequality. The United States actually is one of those. You know, alas, it's true. And so there is, in essence, I think, this is a little bit of an exaggeration, what I'm about to say, but it's almost like there's a developing nation within the United States. There's an underclass that has a low level of education and income, and their reaction to religion is noticeably different to that of people who have a very comfortable life and education and things like that. And the evangelical churches, as a broad generalization, are thickly populated with members of that group. So that's, I think all that flows together to maybe explain a little bit about why they're visible politically in the way that they're visible. I don't know. But I agree with you, Liz, that the statistics on a lot of things here don't provide terribly satisfying answers at the end of the day. Who else has something? Yeah, Jack.
Do you plan to write a letter to the authors pointing out some of the issues that you've just shared with us, so that perhaps they might reconsider their conclusions or go into another book that would cover those topics?
Or might school me on what I'm missing here. You know, I'm not a sociologist, but you know my motto, often wrong, seldom in doubt. not really. But I actually would like to know what they would say if they were a fly on the wall today. Because these things that I've pointed out, you don't have to be a sociologist to see. If you're just looking at the information and you can stare your way through the blizzard of it and think with a little bit of common sense about it, it's like, well, gee, why didn't they do this? And why is this such a missing piece? They're smart people, and they worked very hard on the book. I don't have any reason to doubt their motives, you know. Anyway. Okay. Okay. Virginia doesn't want me to equate social science with sociology, and that's a fair point. That's a little bit of an elision there on my part. Mea culpa. Yeah.
One question I'd come up with, you were focusing on human development, and it kind of popped up in my mind the next minute you had slide 34, and it kind of hit me, was had to do with government. Mm-hmm. We're seeing this from our viewpoint with freedom of religion, and I'm thinking, we're talking worldwide in a lot of countries with people that can't be talking about this freely. And I was thinking, well, what about all these countries where they're not thinking on their own about it? And then I see you brought this up, and I wish we had the slide, but South Africa, well, you're looking at 1981 and 2001. Well, of course, then all of a sudden, what's happening within there, their meaning of life. And then you see this plateau in Spain. Well, when a government is structured a lot around religion. So that whole factor was not a part of all of this, because in certain countries, it's controlled. So
yeah, it's a good,
that's hard
good point.
Because it varies throughout the world.
Yeah.
And the other quick point was, yeah, I don't know about the Pew Forum. They kind of missed out on Islam when they were talking about the major things you had on both sides. There was no Islam on that.
Well, the ones I put on the two sides were the ones on each extreme, and those were in the United States. And the presence of Islam in the United States is small.
Oh, okay.
So they do have, you know, an acknowledgement of the Islamic religion in their study. Certainly it's there. They didn't overlook it. In fact, well, yeah, I mean, they're there. Yeah. Who else? Yeah, Joel.
I want to throw out one other thought that might muddy the waters even more.
Please.
That's culture. The television, media, radio, internet, that's all affecting all of us. And how does that affect people's thinking about religion? I think I actually think for young people, like, the culture is overwhelming. They are so overwhelmingly involved with the culture, and it's affecting them. And we all are, but particularly young people, I think, are wrapped up in it. I don't have any answers, just a big question.
I agree with that very much, Joel. And in particular, what I would call the culture of instantaneity. It's like you've seen these studies about how kids don't know any history from 25 years ago. They're really vague about when the Civil War happened. Because anything more distant than, you name it, 6 months, whatever, is kind of like, oh, well, you know, that's gone. And not a whole lot of future-oriented thinking either. Everything is kind of in the present moment, and it's all texting and now Twittering, getting educated by Karen about Twittering, the newest technological thing that's even more instantaneous than texting. Article in yesterday's Times about texting in church. Young people are texting in church in a conscientious way, asking questions of the director of worship about what the minister is saying as he's saying it. And they're sitting there. So anyway, I think those things have an impact on how people think about the notion of place. You know, staying in one place actually long enough to have some longitudinal, if I can use that word, experience with the same people over time and actually get to know them. All this, you know, mobility and thinness in the it's like the connections are an inch deep and a mile wide. That for our young people, that's what we have. So I think you're absolutely right, Joel. Who else has a Pat, you have a comment?
What about the growing complexity of family life and its relationship? I mean, the kinds of problems people run into. I mean, you've got two kids on drugs, and you've got intermarriage and all these other things that make life exceedingly more complex, and you feel the need for something beyond yourself to help you understand it.
Yeah, what about that? There's a lot of complexity that if religion is going to speak to people's lives, it has to somehow open the aperture of the camera wide enough to say, this is all of what we're dealing with, you know, in the world today. And not just kind of, you know, I think there's complacency in institutional religion. I don't want to be too hard on institutional religion. I'm part of it, but sort of. I think there's a tendency in institutions to become complacent and to do the same things we've always done and kind of go along and not notice, you know, that the world has changed a lot. Railroads thought they were in the railroad business. They didn't know they were in the transportation business. So they got practically run out of that business because they didn't understand what their mission really was. And I think you can look at churches that way too. Who else has some? Steve in the back? Steve?
I'm hoping in the third installment you're going to get to this question, but I'm wondering, what does this all mean to the future of Unitarianism Universalist? Keeping in mind some of the recent national advertising campaign I've seen in major magazines by the Unitarians that seems to be targeting their understanding that there are a lot of people out there that are spiritual but are leaving major organized religion. How do all these facts and figures impact that, and what has been the result of these ads that we've been seeing and that we've been running?
Yeah, I really appreciate you giving me a full week to develop an answer to that question. Appreciate that. Yeah, I'll get back to you. We can take one or two more questions. Does somebody, or comments, or whatever. Does anybody else have something they want to... Does someone want the last word? Okay, so thank you all for being patient with the inundation of statistics. See you next week. Yeah.